This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Patino, for joining us from Quito, Ecuador. Our interview with Sherif Abdelkaddous, Democracy Now! Correspondent in Cairo, will conduct after this broadcast and we'll post it at democracynow.org. Special thanks to our translator, Cassandra Smithies. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Fell, Sarah Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Dina Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard around the web at www.kboo.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Up next is the KBOO Evening News, right after these messages.
On Thursday, July 18th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m., KBOO will be broadcasting the first town hall meeting called by the nonprofit group Article 5 Convention for Our Children's Future on the issue of the National Defense Budget. Experts on the panel include Dr. Robert Pollan, Dr. Miriam Pemberton, and Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Once again, you can tune in on Thursday, July 18th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor What the Festival, July 26th through 28th, 2013, at Wolf Run Ranch in Oregon. Featuring over 50 electronic and dance artists, including Purity Ring, A-Track, RJD2, and Tycho, as well as on-site art installations, a hookah lounge, and splash pool. That's July 26th through 28th, 2013, at Wolf Run Ranch in Oregon. Tickets on sale now at whatthefestival.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News...
Protesters gather in Portland in solidarity with hunger-striking prisoners in California.
The city of Portland announces a plan to install a suicide barrier on Vista Bridge.
Protests continue as the state holds its final hearing regarding a proposed coal export terminal on the Columbia River. Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 9th, 2013. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Don Merrill. Protesters are currently gathered outside the Oregon Convention Center, where a public hearing is being held regarding a coal export terminal on the Oregon coast. The hearing is focused on air and water quality permits needed to transport coal from Montana and Wyoming into a proposed terminal in Boardman, Oregon. The permits from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, would be an initial approval step to Amber Energy's plans to build the first export terminal along the Columbia River. According to this proposal, almost 9 million tons of coal would be carried from Montana and Wyoming to Boardman by train. The coal would then be transferred to barges and sent down the Columbia River to the port of St. Helens, where it would be eventually shipped to Asia. For more, we go to KBOO's Josie Lichten, who is live at the scene of the protest. Josie, what's it look like there at the Oregon Convention Center?
Hi. Well, there are people gathering in front of the Convention Center at this moment. Most are affiliated with associations interested in protecting the gorge. The protest hasn't started yet. It starts at 5:30, but it looks like it's going to be a pretty big gathering.
How many people are there so far, do you know? Any idea?
I would say there are about 25 to 50 people here at the moment, but there are more and more people arriving as I speak.
Okay. And how long will the protest be going on until? Any idea?
I'm not quite sure, but I have a feeling it'll be lasting until 8 p.m. when the public hearing ends.
Okay, Josie. Thanks a lot. Thanks for reporting.
No problem.
That was KBOO's Josie... Oh, Josie, if you're still there, do you have someone there that you can talk to? Do you have an organizer there with you?
Absolutely. So
I'm here right now with Samantha Lockhart. And Samantha, what exactly do you do?
I'm a conservation organizer with Friends of the Columbia Gorge. I work with the Power Pass Coalition on the field team here to stop coal exports.
All right. So I was just wondering, Samantha, what's your opinion on the Enbridge Corporation's coal exports?
Well, this facility is just a bad idea top to bottom, as well as their Millennium Bulk Terminals facility in Longview, Washington. This is a company that has a history of lying to communities. It's a facility that would involve shipping coal on uncovered rail cars for 900 miles, 9 million tons of coal per year, transferring it to barges, and nearly doubling barge traffic on the river and really hurting river recreation and tourism. So it's a bad idea, and Oregon DEQ and Governor Kitzhaber need to deny these permits.
All right. Thank you so much. Back to you, KBOO.
Okay, Josie. That was KBOO reporter Josie Lichten. The Oregon DEQ announced last week it would extend the general comment period an extra month to August 12th. Comments can be made at today's hearing or submitted through fax, mail, or the DEQ website. The Department of Environmental Quality hearings continue until 8 p.m. tonight at the Oregon Convention Center.
Canadian authorities began a criminal investigation today on the disastrous crash of a runaway oil train. Police Inspector Michel Forget said his investigators have found, quote, elements, unquote, that indicate that the train had been tampered with. A fire occurred on the train a few hours before the crash. The train stopped in the town of Nantes, where firefighters shut down the engine and put out the blaze. Investigators now believe that a separate engine powering the brakes was shut down at the same time. This may have caused the brake failure that sent the train barreling into the small Quebec town of Lac Mégantique last Saturday. Forget did rule out terrorism or malicious intent as a cause for the crash. The disaster has resulted in a current death toll of 15. There are still 35 missing victims. Authorities fear that there are dozens of additional bodies buried in the burnt wreckage of the town and that some of the missing may have been vaporized in the crash.
The Vista Bridge in southwest Portland has been a common location for suicides, and the city has planned to install safety barriers on the bridge. Here's more on that story. Less than a month ago, a 15-year-old Beaverton girl ended her life by jumping off the Vista Bridge. She was only the latest of dozens of people who have jumped off the bridge since its construction in the early 1920s. Today, Portland Commissioner Steve Novak approved an emergency request from the Bureau of Transportation to erect temporary suicide barriers on the Vista Bridge in southeast Portland.
It's great news.
Kenneth Kahn is an attorney in southeast Portland who heads an organization called Friends of the Vista Bridge.
Because it finally means that the city can reclaim the true name of the Vista Bridge for what it is, the Vista Bridge, instead of as a killing machine, which is what it was.
From your experience, how do you feel that local organizations have been affected by the fact that people have used the Vista Bridge as a place to leave this life?
Well, it's just not local organizations. I've spoken to people who've worked at TriMet, and they're horribly affected. There are also children and other people who are vulnerable who are trapped on the MAX trains, and they're also affected. I can only assume that everybody's breathing a collective sigh of relief at this point.
Another such organization breathing a sigh of relief is Cascadia Behavioral Health. Ashley Flynn is the Development and Communications Director.
You know, it's a positive step in the right direction. It is sort of like an end stage preventive measure. You know, when things have gotten really bad, people go to the bridge. And so, you know, it's a step in the right direction there, because once they get there, I mean, that's a pretty scary place for somebody to find themselves. So to just remove that as an option is a positive thing. In general, we need to do a lot more prevention, and that is a hard, challenging scope of work.
Mr. Kahn says that in addition to the barriers that the city is putting up, this represents only the beginning of a several-phase project to restore the bridge.
The next step is that we are going to be raising money. We'll need to get about $2.5 million to erect a permanent modification that will be architecturally appropriate. Lines for Life, our fiscal sponsors, is going to be working with us in terms of our fundraising effort. And Lines for Life are the people who are responsible for the suicide hotlines and also for putting on the signs on the bridge when a person is in crisis.
It's unfortunate that we have such a high suicide rate. I think that the issue is really prevention and starting to reach people early with a message of some sort of hope and compassion, you know, before it gets to the stage where they are actually, you know, they have this notion of themselves jumping off a bridge and then all of a sudden they're on that bridge. I mean, we want to try to avoid that.
I'm Don Merrill, KBOO News.
500 gallons of sewage overflowed from a manhole in southwest Portland on Monday night. The sewage spill occurred on the corner of Southwest 69th Avenue and Southwest Railroad Street. It came from the problematic Fano Creek sewage line and occurred when city staff was refilling a pressure sewer. Portland Environmental Services and Clean Water Services have cleaned and disinfected the area. The spill did not reach a waterway.
The statistical analysis firm CoreLogic says foreclosure activity nationally fell by over 27% from where it was a year ago, with 19,000 fewer foreclosures. But that hasn't translated into more housing for people who need it. Here's more in this report.
Oregon lenders foreclosed on 4,500 homes in the 12 months ending in May. Although the overall number of mortgages in some stage of foreclosure has fallen, it doesn't mean more housing. And according to Steve Rudman, the executive director of Multnomah County's housing assistance program, Home Forward, those slightly better numbers also don't mean fewer people need housing.
Well, it has some impact in terms of the home ownership market rebounding so that people are able to stay in their homes instead of losing in foreclosure. So the market is definitely getting stronger, but we still are in a place, particularly in the Portland metropolitan area, where there's many more folks seeking housing than there is supply. So the rental market is also very stretched. It is some of the lowest vacancy rates in Portland's history, the last two or three decades. So it's a very tight rental market today.
You know, the foreclosure activity report, the monthly foreclosure activity statistics are a point-in-time measure of how much new damage is being done.
Angela Martin, Executive Director of Economic Fairness Oregon.
It's not telling us the story of have we repaired the damage that was already done by a five-year sustained foreclosure crisis. That I would also add to that, the fact that we will continue to see monthly fluctuations in a foreclosure activity. They are subject to seasonal variants where there are holidays in that particular month. They are subject to legal up and down, especially here in Oregon, where lenders have really held back on filing foreclosures as they were waiting for important court rulings, which came through just last month. We'll also see a slowdown now that lenders are adjusting to a new foreclosure mediation law that will go into effect in August. So, again, that month-to-month number isn't telling us a whole lot. We want to see the foreclosure crisis be done with. The damage has been long and sustained and touched all of us. But I don't feel that that month-to-month number is going to be our measuring stick for where we are in the foreclosure crisis. I think more important would be to look at the economic health of the families who have already suffered, in particular minority homeowners, who have seen a loss of personal wealth, upwards of 40% of their personal wealth wiped out due to this foreclosure crisis. It's going to be years, if not an entire generation, until we make up the economic damage that happened there.
And Mr. Rudman sees that damage as a swell of new applicants on a newly opened waiting list for housing.
We opened up our waiting list for the first time in 6 years. In November, we got 21,000 applications in 1 week. We're going to be able to assist maybe 3,000 of those households in the next 5 years. And this is before federal sequestration occurred, where we lost basically $5 million in funding because of the across-the-board cuts at the federal government level.
Again, Angela Martin with Economic Fairness Oregon.
We've never been to at a point that I can recall where we were meeting the housing needs of all of our community. And so when you talk about programs like Home Forward, they've always struggled with a limited number of funding that didn't stretch to meet all of the need out there. So it's not surprising to me that they are not seeing any let up in the number of people seeking services, because we still have way too many families, working families, families with and without income, who simply cannot afford housing.
I'm Don Merrill.
Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, filed a complaint with the Internal Revenue Service today. The complaint was against campaign finance lawyer James Bopp Jr., his law firm, and the conservative nonprofit Bopp represents as general counsel. CREW alleges that Bopp owes over $6 million in excise taxes. The organization also accused him of using his Indiana-based nonprofit to funnel money into his law firm. Bopp is the sole employee of the James Madison Center for Free Speech, a conservative nonprofit with anti-abortion and anti-marriage equality clients. The lawyer was also the lead legal advisor for Citizens United. CREW has also filed complaints against Bopp with Indiana State Attorney General and the U.S. Attorney.
The campaign to legalize gay marriage in Oregon received a significant financial boost today. Freedom to Marry is a national group fighting to legalize gay marriage across the country. It announced today that it will donate $250,000 to Oregon's gay marriage campaign. Aside from Oregon, the group is also targeting Hawaii, Illinois, and New Jersey. It hopes to help legalize gay marriage in these states over the next 2 years. According to the Oregonian newspaper, the amount is the largest donation this year on either side of the state's fight over gay marriage. Amy Ruiz, spokeswoman for Basic Rights Oregon, expressed gratitude for the donation. The donation boosts their campaign's fundraising total to nearly $550,000. The donation is timely due to the federal government's announcement that civil unions or any state arrangement short of marriage will not be federally recognized. Currently, gay couples in Oregon can register for domestic partnerships, which grants state-level rights afforded to heterosexual married couples. Domestic partnerships will not be recognized federally, despite the Supreme Court overturning the Federal Defense of Marriage Act.
Yesterday, a former owner and executive of a local software company was sentenced for tax evasion after unsuccessfully arguing that paying his taxes violated his religious principles. U.S. District Judge Michael Simon gave Chester Evans Davis of Oregon City an 8-year jail sentence. Davis, former president and owner of power system software company ESA International, is also required to pay $7 million he owes in state and federal taxes. After a March conviction for tax evasion, failing to file corporate tax returns, and ignoring tax laws, Davis told the court that filing taxes would violate his, quote, blood covenant with God. Davis claimed paying taxes would elevate the status of the state above God and that the court had no jurisdiction over him as a Christian. Assistant U.S. Attorney Stacey Beckerman noted that people of all religious affiliations and professions pay their taxes. According to the Oregonian, the judge noted the irony that Davis wouldn't pay his taxes despite owing much of his company's success to federal contracts.
Around 100 protesters gathered outside the Justice Center in downtown Portland last night to show solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners in Pelican Bay, California. The protest was part of a National Day of Action in support of hunger strikers. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg was there and brings us the sound of the noise demo.
Bang, bang, it's the new American chain gang.
We are here tonight to show solidarity with prison strikers at Pelican Bay Correctional Institute in Northern California, as well as with prisoners joining the struggle throughout the West Coast and across the country demanding basic human rights.
I got a report this morning that prisoners in Oregon are planning to organize solidarity strikes in solidarity with Northern California. Imagine how hard that is. Many of us can barely organize our own lives and we're walking around free. Like, imagine how hard it is to organize between prisons, like between cells, just individual cells, and then between prisons across states. Imagine how much effort that takes. It takes years to build up. So we know that these people are dehumanized to the extent that they're willing to put their lives on the line.
The good news is that there's a lot of stuff we can do. We got a lot of options in this area. Jericho, here in Portland and everywhere else, they organize prisoner writing nights. For those of you who are like, well, I want to do something right now, that's something you can do. Because I've grown up knowing a lot of people in the prison, spending some time when I was young in and out of some of them myself. So I can tell you that little letter, that little visit, that means a lot to people who are in there. That's their only connection to the outside world. So don't sell it short. If you can visit someone, even if you can visit somebody in here, that makes a big difference. A lot of people have nobody coming to see about them. Nobody. Years and years of nobody coming to see about them. You could be that person to help give them hope. So if you can do that, please do it, because that's something you can do right now, today, to make a difference.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after this newscast, followed by Out Loud, KBOO's queer culture radio show at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy with a high near 79.
So the prophet is never really here for me. I'm not denying, oh, Lord, but you're so the prophet is never honored. You know him, oh, Lord, yeah, yeah, yeah. So the prophet is never honored. You know him, oh,
It's 5:21, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Come on, team, let's get mean. This is not the chant of rabid football fans egging on their team to pound their opponents. Rather, this is the raucous war cry of far-out right-wing ideologues pumping up Team GOP to pound the bejesus out of America's millions of unemployed workers. Far from a game, this is real, and it's a moral abomination. I've been unemployed before, and I can tell you, it's a misery. All the more so today, when there are far more people out of work than there are job openings. This leaves millions of our fellow Americans mired in the debilitating misery of long-term unemployment. But that's not miserable enough for a feral breed of Ayn Randian zealots who are lobbying Republican governors, legislators, and Congress critters to punish the jobless for, well, for their joblessness. In this perverse universe, unemployment benefits and other poverty prevention programs are sapping our nation's vitality by allowing moochers to live the life of Riley and avoid work. The GOP's budget demigod, Representative Paul Ryan, summarized this doctrine in a fanciful homily deriding America's tattered safety net as, quote, a hammock that lulls able-bodied people to lives of dependency and complacency. This from a guy who has spent his adult life in the sweet swaying hammock of congressional privilege. As ridiculous and just plain mean as this attitude is, it plays well in the insanity of Republican primary elections. So state after state, as well as the U.S. House, are succumbing to this pound-the-poor right-wing dogma by frenetically slashing unemployment benefits. This is Jim Hightower saying, behind this faux philosophical push are the smiling barons of corporate America. Without jobless payments, you see, desperate millions will be forced to take jobs on whatever miserable terms the barons decree.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Today, a lesbian couple partnered with the American Civil Liberties Union to file a lawsuit against Pennsylvania's ban on gay marriage. Deb and Susan Whitewood reside in Pittsburgh. They are two of 23 plaintiffs that are working with the ACLU to challenge state bans on gay marriage. The couple and the ACLU plan to attack the gay marriage ban through courts because it is unlikely the Republican-controlled Pennsylvania legislature will change it. The Whitewoods have been together for 22 years and have two teenage daughters.
The level of radioactivity at the Fukushima nuclear plant in Japan has surged 90-fold in the last 3 days. This surge in radioactivity comes as the Japanese nuclear industry has made a push for more nuclear plants and a day after new safety rules were implemented. The operator of the Fukushima nuclear station, hit by the earthquake and tsunami 2 years ago, said that an observation well 25 yards from the sea showed groundwater levels of radioactivity of cesium were 90 times higher on Monday than they had been 3 days before. The new level of radiation is 140 times above Japan's safety standard. On July 5th, the reactor operator, known as TEPCO, found that another radioactive isotope known as tritium has also been increasing in the groundwater. The tritium level measured on July 5th is 10 times above Japan's safety level and is now the highest level that the utility has recorded since the accident. TEPCO says that it is now attempting to determine if the radioactive groundwater is seeping into the ocean, which could impact marine life and humans who eat contaminated seafood. According to a Reuters interview of a senior Japanese regulator today, Japan hopes to restart several nuclear reactors in about a year. Four utility companies are applying for safety inspections for 10 idled plants, or what the AP calls, quote, the clearest sign of a return to atomic energy almost 2.5 years after the Fukushima disaster.
Anti-secrecy group WikiLeaks stated today that former NSA agent Edward Snowden has not yet accepted asylum in Venezuela, as has been rumored. Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro offered Snowden asylum last Friday. Today's rumor started when a tweet on the account of Russian politician Alexei Pushkov stated that Snowden had indeed accepted the Venezuelan offer. The mistaken tweet swiftly disappeared from Pushkov's account. Bolivia and Nicaragua also offered Snowden asylum. Snowden's whereabouts are still unknown, but authorities suspect that Snowden is hiding in a Moscow airport.
A roadside bomb in western Afghanistan killed 17 civilians, including 4 children. A series of similar blasts killed 9 people several days ago. Today's bomb exploded under a trailer packed with villagers traveling to a ceremony in this unusually stable western province. 7 others were wounded, including 5 children. A police spokesman said Taliban insurgents were responsible for the blast. A senior Afghan general this week said insurgents had stepped up operations in the east near Pakistan as foreign troops continued to leave the country ahead of a 2014 withdrawal deadline. In a related New York Times report today, the U.S. is considering a faster pullout from Afghanistan and a so-called zero option, whereby no U.S. troops would remain in the country.
Today, the military-led interim government in Egypt released a 6-month plan for return to a democratically elected government. Military-appointed interim president Adli Mansour, who served as Chief Justice of the Supreme Constitutional Court, also appointed liberal economist and former finance minister Hazem El-Bablai interim prime minister. Nobel laureate Mohamed El-Baradei was named temporary vice president for foreign relations. The plan will overhaul Egypt's suspended constitution, elect a new parliament, and choose a president in about 6 months. The first step is the formation of a 10-person committee of 6 top judges and 4 law professors to draft a new charter in the span of about a month. A larger committee of 50 people representing several organizations would then review the charter. If approved, the charter would be put to a public vote and followed by parliamentary elections. The final step would be new presidential elections at the end of the 6-month timetable. The plan is also an attempt by the military to demonstrate their commitment to a democratic government. Islamists, many of whom had been attacked or arrested by the military, including more than 50 killed, insist the interim government is illegitimate. The most prominent Islamist group, the Muslim Brotherhood, argues that the ouster of democratically elected President Mohamed Morsi reversed the gains made in the 2011 revolution that ousted Hosni Mubarak. The White House remains cautious regarding Egypt, focusing primarily on avoiding further violence, but stated it was encouraged by the plan.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service at the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Tuesday, July 9, 2013. Israeli soldiers roll into the Gaza Strip, bulldoze land and uproot trees. In the meantime, a senior Hamas leader warns against interfering in Egyptian affairs. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli authorities have taken action to shut down and censor two theaters, one Palestinian and one Israeli, for performing cultural theater performances that Israel considers to be critical of its political agenda and policies. The affected theaters are the Al-Hakawati Puppet Theater in East Jerusalem and the Khan Theater in West Jerusalem. The puppet theater was scheduled to begin this summer with the 19th annual Al-Hakawati Puppet Festival, but the Israeli Minister of Internal Security, Yitzhak Aharonovich, shut down the festival by claiming that puppet theater was connected with the Palestinian Authority. The theater owners vehemently deny that any of their funding came from the Palestinian Authority and have opened their account books publicly to verify this fact. A Palestinian security source in the Gaza Strip reported that a number of Israeli military vehicles advanced on Tuesday at dawn, hundreds of meters into Al-Harara town, northeast of Khan Yunis city in the southern Gaza Strip. The source reported that six armored military bulldozers, accompanied by several armored vehicles, advanced into the area and uprooted Palestinian farmland, especially land close to the enforced fence on the western side of the Gaza Strip. No clashes have been reported. Despite the ceasefire agreement, mediated by Egypt last December, Israeli soldiers carried out hundreds of limited invasions into the coastal region and continued their attacks against the residents, including fishermen and farmers. In political news, legislator Yahya Musa of the Hamas movement stated that Hamas in the Gaza Strip will pay a heavy price for interfering in internal Egyptian affairs, and he called on his movement to reconsider its regional policies, especially with neighboring countries. In an interview with the Watan news agency, Musa said that Hamas, as an Islamist movement, supports the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but does not have the right to interfere in internal Egyptian affairs. Instead, it must act to stop the bloodshed between the supporters of Morsi's regime and their opponents. He said that meddling in Egyptian affairs would affect the Palestinian people, especially in Gaza, and would lead to the closure of all siege-busting tunnels that have become virtually the only source of goods and supplies to the coastal region. Musa called upon the Hamas leadership to reconsider its foreign policy, especially with Egypt. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, July 9th News Roundup from the Occupied Palestinian Territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Rishmawi and me, Seamus Sloan.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is called Carl Vischer, Patrick McLaughlin, Josie Lichten, Don Merrill, Casey Decker, and Ren Green. The producer is Rebecca Ney. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Ren Green.
And I'm Don Merrill. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Lisa Loving hosts Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, hear a recently recorded interview with noted scholar and author Noam Chomsky, talking about state spying and other matters with host David Barsamian. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andresen and guest Jim Gilbert discuss how to prune your home orchard. And the plant of the month is parsnips. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collection at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Don.
Good night, Ren.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, July 9th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, senators question Obama's nominee to head the FBI, James Comey, on torture and surveillance. Guantanamo detainees enter a fifth month of hunger strike as a federal judge denies a request to halt the painful practice of force feeding. And in California, transgender students get closer to more equality in schools after lawmakers pass a bill that requires public schools to respect gender identity.
Same voices opposing this today. They were the same folks who 15 years ago opposed hospital visitation rights for domestic partners.
Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. Egypt's military-backed interim government issued a decree today setting a six-month timeline for constitutional change and elections. But the Muslim Brotherhood rejected the plan, saying transitional leader Adli Mansour is usurping the legislative process. The Brotherhood also opposed the appointment of Hazim al-Bablawi as prime minister, saying he simply represents more of the Egyptian upper class. The political standoff follows yesterday's violence, during which 51 protesters were killed as they rallied in support of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. Authorities detained and questioned 650 people in connection with the violence. Officials say the demonstrators incited the violence. The Muslim Brotherhood says troops indiscriminately fired. A car bomb in Beirut's Shia-dominated southern suburbs wounded at least 50 people today. The neighborhood is a Hezbollah stronghold, and while no one has yet taken responsibility for the bombing, it comes as sectarian tensions are on the rise, and Lebanese Shia and Sunni fighters continue to pour across the border into Syria. Jackson Allers has more from Beirut.
While no deaths were reported, military experts on the scene say that 40 kilograms of explosives were planted in a stolen SUV, causing massive material damage. Hezbollah holds total political sway over the majority Shia neighborhood of Beirut where the bomb was detonated. Hezbollah government representatives blamed the bombing on the party's publicly stated military support of the Syrian government and its offensive against forces fighting to oust President Bashar al-Assad. Tuesday marked the third attack this year in the Hezbollah-controlled southern suburbs. The bombing follows consistent threats from anti-Assad forces in Lebanon and Syria, who have said they would attack Hezbollah in Beirut until they retreated from Syria. Political parties across the Lebanese sectarian divide condemn the attack. Meanwhile, Hezbollah security teams join Lebanese security officials in cordoning off the area for further investigation, barring journalists from approaching the blast site. Jackson Allers, FSRN, Beirut, Lebanon.
The North Carolina House of Representatives held a public hearing today on efforts to add new licensing requirements for reproductive health facilities that offer pregnancy terminations. Opponents say the costs of complying could cause all but one of the state's such facilities to close. The hearing followed an outcry last week after state lawmakers added anti-abortion amendments to a totally unrelated bill in the Senate, one that would ban Sharia law in the state. The measure passed without any public input at all. Planned Parenthood of Central North Carolina's Paige Johnson urged lawmakers today to block the measure.
We cannot understand how lawmakers could pass sweeping legislation like 695 without allowing a single women's health expert to weigh in publicly when the bill was still eligible to be amended.
Lawmakers in Texas continued their special session on a proposed anti-abortion law today, with House debate nearly identical to that in North Carolina. Texas SB 2 would outlaw abortion after 20 rather than the now legal 24 weeks and would require women's health clinics to meet the standards of ambulatory surgical centers. Women's health rights advocates predict that 37 of the state's 52 existing clinics would be forced to close. And in Wisconsin yesterday, a U.S. district judge temporarily blocked the implementation of a law that mandates doctors performing abortions have hospital admitting privileges. In his ruling, Judge William M. Conley found that the state failed to prove the new requirement provides any benefit to women's health. He did let stand a provision that requires an ultrasound before termination procedures. Conley will take the matter up again at a hearing next week. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington today, senators held a confirmation hearing for former Bush administration attorney James Comey, who was nominated by President Obama to lead the FBI for the next 10 years. Some lawmakers questioned Comey about his role in signing off on waterboarding and other torture methods while working for the Justice Department, and about his past several years working on Wall Street for companies that violated the law. He also faced questions about surveillance, both the wiretapping and web monitoring practices he dealt with under President Bush. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Most senators on the Judiciary Committee praised FBI Director nominee James Comey at Tuesday's hearing and signaled that an easy confirmation vote would happen soon. But some members, including Minnesota Democrat Al Franken, raised concerns about Comey's record both in government and the private sector. A key point that surfaced several times was Comey's role as Deputy Attorney General in signing off on several so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, including waterboarding, slapping, and sleep deprivation. Franken questioned Comey about one of these legal documents.
The detainee is standing in his handcuffs, and the handcuffs are attached by a length of chain to the ceiling. The detainee has approximately a 2 to 3 foot diameter of movement. The memo also says that the detainee wears diapers and that sleep deprivation can cause swelling in the lower extremities. The memo goes on to say that none of this amounts to torture, and it authorized sleep deprivation for up to 180 hours. That's 7.5 days. That is torture, isn't it?
That was my reaction, and I remember that description vividly. Senator, it's one of the things that led me to ask, who are we as Americans? And we have to have that conversation about, even if someone says it's effective, someone says it doesn't violate this vague statute, there's this third question that description cries out for us to answer.
Okay, but I would say that was a memo that you approved.
Comey clarified that while he expressed disapproval at the time, he authorized these interrogation methods anyway. He noted that he only allowed them to be used separately, not in combination, on a detainee. Though it did not come up at the hearing, Comey has also defended the rendition of some people suspected of terrorism who were tortured in other countries. Attorney Shane Cottadall with the Center for Constitutional Rights represented one survivor of this practice.
Comey is the person who personally signed off on the declaration seeking to dismiss our client Maher Arar's rendition case. He was a Canadian citizen flying back from a holiday on the Mediterranean to his home in Canada, was stopped at JFK Airport while he was switching planes, held and interrogated by the U.S. for a while, and then removed not to Canada, the country of his citizenship, but to Syria, the country of his birth, where he knew he would be tortured because the U.S. government basically told them to torture him to investigate any links that he might have to terrorism. The Syrians eventually released him, but the U.S. government's never acknowledged guilt.
Cottadall said Comey's dismissal of the case meant the rendition program never saw the light of day or the accountability a public trial could have brought. He and several senators also took issue with Comey's record on domestic surveillance. Though Comey is best known for opposing the Bush administration's efforts to extend warrantless wiretapping, he expressed support Tuesday for the current system used to monitor the communications of U.S. citizens and foreign nationals. As revealed by data analyst Edward Snowden, the federal government has been requesting permission from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court for the bulk collection of domestic phone and web records, and has won that approval in nearly every case.
Folks don't realize that it's a group of independent federal judges who sit and operate under a statutory regime to review requests by the government to use certain authorities to gather information, and it is anything but a rubber stamp. Anyone who knows federal judges and has appeared before federal judges knows that calling them a rubber stamp is shows you don't have experience before them.
But no ordinary citizen, company, or even Congress member can have any experience before the FISA court, which only hears from the executive branch when it seeks approval for surveillance. For that reason, some lawmakers, including New York Democrat Charles Schumer, took issue with Comey's characterization of the court as independent. At the same time as Comey's hearing, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board held its third ever public hearing, at which several legal and privacy advocates raised concerns about the mass domestic and international surveillance the FISA court has approved. Privacy advocates called on the board to investigate and publicly report on the threats to civil liberties posed by these surveillance programs. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
As the hunger strike at the Guantanamo Bay Military Prison enters its fifth month, more than 100 prisoners continue to refuse solid food in protest. U.S. officials say they continue to force-feed 45 men, a practice that requires a plastic tube to be forced up a prisoner's nostrils, then down their throat twice a day. Prisoners describe it as extremely painful. On Monday, a federal judge dismissed a court challenge from a Guantanamo prisoner to halt the force-feeding, though she criticized the practice itself. Judge Gladys Kessler called the practice painful, humiliating, and degrading, and said that the power to halt it rests with U.S. President Barack Obama. For more, we're joined by Shana Kadidal, Senior Managing Attorney with the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with yesterday's federal court ruling. The judge did deny the request by prisoner Jihad Diab to stop the force feeding. Diab was cleared for release in 2009, but remains in what the judge called indefinite detention at Gitmo. The ruling seems to rest on what the judge calls a lack of jurisdiction. Why can't the judge intervene in this case?
So yesterday, this trial judge, Gladys Kessler, who's one of the more, you know, known as one of